You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Throughout his presidency and political career, Barack Obama has always acknowledged his wife's support. But how did Michelle Obama become who she is today? In Michelle Obama Life, Peter Slevin chronicles the First Lady's journey from her working-class upbringing on Chicago's South Side to her Princeton education all the way to the White House. Mr. Slevin is a professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism and a former Washington Post correspondent. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Why publish this now and not after her husband's presidency is over?
For a couple of reasons. One is I think this is a good moment because she's in the news, she's in the public eye, people are focused on her. And it's also a book that gets at important purposes and causes why she's here. And I thought that would be useful to have out there while we're watching her.
Had you covered them when you were at the Washington Post?
I had. I moved to Chicago for the Post in 2004, just when a guy with a funny name and big ears was running for the U.S. Senate. And in 2007 and 8, I covered the campaign for the Washington Post.
And when he came on our show, not long after he'd made the famous speech at the Democratic Convention, and I asked him about whether he had any plans to run for the presidency, people were already talking about it. He said, no way. I'm a junior senator from Illinois, I think 98th in seniority. He was lying to me.
I think he wasn't lying, except perhaps about the timing. He did have a very funny press conference the very day after he was elected to the U.S. Senate in a record, a true landslide in 2004. And he said, guys, I was elected, 12 hours ago. I am not running. I'm really not running. And I think he meant it for the time.
You talked to many of Michelle's family members and friends from Chicago. Whom did you interview?
So I talked with dozens of her friends, relatives, mentors. In her immediate family, I spoke with two of her uncles, two of her father's brothers. I spoke with one of her mother's sisters. I spoke with a couple of cousins.
Should I assume they only had nice things to say?
I wasn't really asking so much about sort of nice versus mean. I was asking particularly the relatives about family stories, going back into Chicago history.
But you didn't speak to Michelle or Barack.
I have not interviewed Michelle Obama since that first presidential campaign when I spoke with her twice.
Have you gotten any feedback from them after the book was published?
I haven't. I've heard from some of her friends, and I've heard from a number of people who are in her orbit, but not her.
Well, they can't be too displeased. You present Michelle in largely positive terms.
They would find it a pretty thorough, pretty thoughtful book, or at least I certainly hope so.
Her image throughout her husband's presidency has been less outwardly political, and yet you say she is the most consistently political First Lady since Eleanor Roosevelt. I was thinking about some of the others who got involved in politics, Nancy Reagan, Rosalind Carter, Hillary Clinton.
I think that's right. There, every First Lady in one way or another is connected with politics, is political.
But Pat Nixon was much more restrained.
They have their different styles. Nobody gets to the White House and inherits a certain playbook. If you think about Hillary, she tried to do something far more ambitious than Michelle Obama has ever tried, and that was the health care reform that she began very early in her husband's term. It went down in flames, and her involvement in politics, politically, was quite episodic after that. Whereas Michelle is political in a broader sense, in the idea that she has particular purposes, that is to address inequality, for example, and very clear sort of programs, a strategy.
And she gets involved with issues like health and nutrition, the environment.
Very much so, Leonard. And I think that what's striking is there is a line that runs through all of her initiatives in the White House, if you look at them just below the surface. If you think about school lunches, of course, it's about kids being healthy and trying to cut down on childhood obesity, which has its significant costs to society over time. But also keep in mind that in her infamous school lunch proposal, who eats those school lunches? 70% of school lunches are eaten by kids who can't afford to pay full fare. Same within the military, when you think about sort of mom and apple pie when she's trying to help military families. But when she looks for jobs for departing veterans, 80% of them don't actually have more than a high school education.
When Hillary tried to write a new health law with Ira Magaziner, she was writing legislation. Does Michelle see her strength in using the bully pulpit instead?
I think she certainly set out not to be Hillary or to be the non-Hillary when she
arrived.
Do they
get along with each other? Do they know each other?
They do know each other, and they had conversations once Michelle got into the White House, in fact, not least about how to raise kids in the fishbowl. But Michelle was determined not to take on a policy role. And you remember, you mentioned, you know, Rosalynn Carter. She would sit in on cabinet meetings. She's not that she doesn't see that as her strength. She does see her strength as the bully pulpit, as you say, and by kind of mobilizing, convening.
We're talking about Michelle Obama, which is the title of Peter Slevin's book, Michelle Obama, A Life. You trace her family history all the way back to slavery. What were her ancestors' lives like?
I focus in particular on her grandparents and her parents. Three of her grandparents came north in the Great Migration, reaching Chicago at a time when it was awfully hard for African Americans in a deeply segregated city. She once said of her paternal grandfather that if he had been born white, he would have been a banker. In fact, he was in the military. He was then in the post office. Another of her other grandfather was a skilled tradesman, a carpenter, but he couldn't get a well-paying job in Chicago because he was not permitted as a black man to join the labor union.
Didn't I read recently, this is not in your book, but I guess Skip Gates will put it in his book, that she has genetic links to Stephen Colbert, Charlemagne, and one of the English kings?
I would not be surprised. Don't we all have links to everyone these days?
What kind of upbringing did her parents, Marion and Fraser Robinson III, have?
Her parents are just intriguing characters. I mean, one of the things that was so fun about working on this book was discovering her many relatives in this very large family on the south side of Chicago. Fraser Robinson was born in 1935. Her mother, Marion Shields, was born in 1937 in very working class conditions.
In Chicago.
In Chicago.
Not in Kenya.
In Chicago itself. And Fraser Robinson graduated from high school in 1953 from DuSable High, and Michelle thinks he would have been an artist if he only could have. He couldn't afford to go to college for very long. His mother, her mother's parents actually wanted her to be a teacher, but she wasn't so interested in that.
But I get the sense that Michelle thinks all of her ancestors could have been something else or would have been something else if race hadn't stopped them.
She's very clear that there's a legacy of racism and bigotry in this country that held African Americans down, and she's been quite explicit about that in her own family.
Was she a good student?
She was a very good student, a lot of it through very, very hard work. Her brother was 2 years ahead of her.
Craig
Robinson. He went off to Princeton. Someone said of him that he could, you know, pass a test by just carrying a book under his arm. Michelle worked for it. She would get up before dawn. She would ride the bus all the way to her magnet school, studying all the way, as the stories go.
Were they brought up differently from the other kids in the neighborhood?
Michelle's mother was one of the very few stay-at-home moms in the neighborhood, which is interesting when you consider that Michelle's father worked at the city water plant his entire career. The fact that the family could live on his own salary, and both of them were quite active in their schools. For example, Aunt Robbie, who lived in the house, taught piano lessons and helped out in musical performances and so forth as well.
And Craig went to Princeton, but you write that he had gotten better scholarship money from other schools. His father insisted that he go to Princeton.
It's a fascinating story. They were standing in the kitchen of their very small apartment, which is also where they had meals one night. And Craig, who was a basketball player and quite a good one, had gotten a full ride, an offer of a full scholarship at the University of Washington, but he kind of wanted to go to Princeton. He laid it out to his father and explained to his father that he really thought he would go to the state university because, after all, it was free. And his father kind of stroked his chin and said, well, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I sure would be disappointed if you made a decision this important on the basis of money. And Craig said it was the greatest act of generosity he had seen in his life. And the Robinsons paid their share of his education, sometimes with their credit card.
And then they sent Michelle to Princeton as well.
And Michelle said, well, if he can get into Princeton, I can get into Princeton. I'm not going to let anything stop me.
But it wasn't easy. We think of Princeton as a liberal school, but didn't they face racism, they say?
It's unquestioned that Princeton was a tough place for a black student to be.
Even a basketball player?
In the sense that, of
course, athletes get a different kind of a ride than everyone else.
Sure. It wasn't so much that Craig and Michelle would have been looked down upon kind of individually, but Michelle said that she was more aware of her blackness at Princeton than she ever had been growing up in a largely segregated neighborhood in Chicago or even at her diverse magnet school.
When she wrote her senior thesis about race relations at Princeton, was she gaining some kind of revenge there or just using the bully pulpit again?
I think she was exploring what she was thinking and feeling and experiencing as a black student entering the American elite, which was so white and so dominated by white people. She was asking, what is the relationship between an African-American in the elite who has succeeded to many other black people who are left behind?
What were her ambitions after school?
She wasn't really sure what she wanted to be, and she's quite open about that. She actually said that she found while she was at Princeton she was becoming more conservative in her ambitions, in the sense that she too found that she wanted to get into an elite professional school or work for a corporation where she could make real money, things that were not on her radar when she was a girl in Chicago.
And that wound up being Harvard Law School.
And she ended up going to Harvard Law School, and she's talked about that as well. And she has said that she kind of went there by default. You know, didn't know exactly what she was going to do, but hey, let's go to Harvard. That's a neat thing to do, and that'll look good on my resume, and then I'll figure it out when I get there.
And then she went to work for a well-known law firm.
She did. And those Harvard years, Leonard, were important to her, too. She had what one friend called a critical mass of African-Americans at Harvard at a time when much of the discussion was about race. This was the 1980s. This was Reagan. And students and faculty were asking pretty critical questions about where the civil rights movement had come from, where it was headed, and how change could actually happen. And one big question that she was asking and her friends were asking was, what is the role of law? What is the role of lawyers? What is the role of black lawyers?
And at a certain point, there were complaints at a number of top law schools, the fact that there were no African Americans on the faculties.
This was an important issue while she was there. Absolutely right. And the Black Law Students Association at Harvard at the time lobbied pretty hard, the then dean, Dean Vorenberg, about this. And I found in my research a fascinating essay that Michelle wrote, about 3,000 words long, where she was arguing that, you know, Harvard is so well known for the paper chase and Scott Turow's 1L with this kind of image of imperious superiority. How about having a much more diverse faculty where you would have people of color and women teaching the law in a very different way and connecting with students in a different way?
And then she met Barack, and we will take a little break and come back with that. My guest is Peter Slevin, who spent a decade on the national staff of the Washington Post before he joined Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, where he's an associate professor. His book is called Michelle Obama, A Life. It is published by Knopf. And I hope you'll stay with us for more. We're back with Peter Slevin, who has written a biography of Michelle Obama, Michelle Obama, A Life. It's published by Knopf. So how did Michelle and Barack meet? She was, she had been termed as, labeled as almost unmarriageable.
that was a line that her family used because she was so demanding. And
they said, she said, my family swore I would never find a man that would put up with me.
Exactly. She was tough. She was strong. She was smart. she has had and continues to have very strong ideas about the world. She met Barack Obama at Sidley & Austin, a white shoe law firm in Chicago, when she was assigned to be his mentor. She actually, even though she's younger than he is, you might remember that he spent 3 years as a community organizer on the south side of Chicago before he went to Harvard. So she graduated from Harvard ahead of him, and they met the summer after his first year.
Mm-hmm. And so was there any question as to whether they would spend the rest of their life doing corporate law?
Well, in fact, one of the ways they connected that first summer was when Michelle watched Barack in action in a church basement, where he went back to see some of the people he had worked with as a community organizer. And he spoke with them about possibility. He spoke with them about being activists. He spoke about the idea of the world as it is and the world as it should be. And she said she fell in love with him that day because of that notion that it is worth working for that future world.
What did her family think of Barack when they first met him?
Well, it's interesting. Her mother told an interviewer in 2004 that she was just a little nervous because Barack had a white mother. She thought that might be tricky for their prospective children, but she got over that very, very quickly and in fact, was quite charmed.
Were they happier when Michelle dated Patti LaBelle's son?
We don't know what they thought about Stanley Stalker at that particular moment. He seems a very charming guy.
Where were they working when they were married in 1992?
In 1992, he had finished at Harvard Law School, where he'd been elected the first black president of the Harvard Law Review, and he'd come back to Chicago, had decided not to go be a federal clerk for a judge, a clerk for a federal judge. He had decided not to go to work for a fancy law firm. He was actually registering voters in Chicago under the motto, "It's a power thing." The idea was to help get Carol Moseley Braun elected to the Senate that year.
So was she the one who was really the big wage earner at the time? Because they talk about struggling despite the fact that they weren't poor.
They weren't poor, and I think they weren't struggling, I think it's safe to say. They had steady income coming in. He cobbled together a diverse array of jobs, but each one of them paid. He was a constitutional law professor, after all, at the University of Chicago. He worked for a boutique law firm that did some important civil rights work. He soon would publish his first book that would make them millions when it was reissued after the 2004 speech at the Democratic National Convention.
What kind of relationship did Michelle have with Barack's mother, Ann Dunham?
I don't know much about her relationship with Ann Dunham.
Who died just a few years later.
She died, that's right, she died not long after they met. It was just a few years later in 1995. And they never lived in the same place. Indeed, Ann Dunham was still working abroad as a as an anthropologist for much of that time. She did come to the wedding, which was in Chicago. At that time, she was working on microfinance, but again, far from U.S. shores.
We assume in these kinds of relationships that the wife functions as an advisor. Jimmy Carter talked about Rosalynn being his most important advisor, and Nancy obviously would feed Ronald lines. We can go on and on and on. What about Michelle and Barack, because she campaigned with him from the very beginning of his political career?
I was particularly interested in the comment that one of their friends made, that Michelle is the most do-what's-right person in Barack's circle, that sense that she is true north in terms of policy. She is credited by Barack himself as having a very good sense of people, a judgment for personnel, but also a judgment for how his words are selling. And there have been various times in the campaign, in his political career, when he has really leaned on that instinct. And some of the strategists, in fact, say that she has, in some ways, better political instincts than he does.
But she disliked campaigning at first.
She disliked campaigning, and I think it's deeper than that, even. She had a considerable disdain, might be too strong, but dislike of politics dating to her youth on the south side of Chicago.
And then she was sacrificing her own career.
Very important thing that I think we sometimes forget. In order to sign on, which she did, to Barack's quest for the presidency, Michelle had to give up a very formidable identity, independent identity on this that she developed in Chicago in a 20-year professional career, 10 of those as a working mother, as a civic player, as a professional player, and largely reinvent herself on the campaign trail under that harsh, incredibly harsh light.
Barack has only lost one race in his political career, 2000 Democratic congressional primary against Bobby Rush, who was a much more militant person than Barack Obama.
Very different generation, in fact. Bobby Rush had indeed been a member of the Black Panthers. His son Huey, who was actually killed during that campaign, was named Huey for Huey P. Newton. And Barack Obama argued that Bobby Rush was a little tired, that his politics didn't really translate in the year 2000. His constituents, however, Bobby Rush's constituents, didn't see it that way at all and couldn't see any good reason to toss him out.
There's something ironic in the fact that there are people on the right today who see Barack Obama as some kind of bomb-throwing radical, when in all of these races, he was kind of the middle-of-the-road Democrat.
Barack Obama is a very pragmatic politician. He has progressive views, there's no question, but that he is very concerned, as is Michelle, about inequality and the stacked deck. But a bomb thrower, he is not, nor has ever been.
What role did Michelle play in the 2008 campaign? First of all, how did she help him bounce back after the defeat?
Helped him bounce back by encouraging him to find another line of work. She thought that maybe it's about time, Barack, that you got a job a little closer to home, no commuting to Springfield. She said of his work in politics in Springfield, Illinois, where he was a state senator for 8 years, it is just not noble, that profession. And what she did in 2002, however, after he decided he just needed to give it one more shot, that private life wasn't ready for that just yet, was to say, yes, you can run for the U.S. Senate.
My guest is Peter Slevin, Professor Peter Slevin of Northwestern University. He's written a biography, Michelle Obama, A Life, that is published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The 2008 presidential race had a number of significant female figures in it, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, plus Bill Clinton as a rival political spouse. How did she stand apart from them?
Her job, her first role, her most essential role, was to validate Barack Obama to a variety of audiences in a variety of different ways. Entering the race as his, sort of primary backer, she said, I can do this, but I need to be true to myself. I need to talk about the things that ring true with me. I need to be straight and authentic. And she stood apart by telling stories of their lives that rang so true with audiences all over the country of all races and ethnicities and genders.
Now, we have heard in the past about how wives, first ladies, didn't always agree with their husbands. Eleanor Roosevelt would engage in debates with FDR, but a number of others had different political philosophies. Does she go along with everything? Because Barack Obama has angered some people in his own party for some of the things that he has proposed, including a new trade deal most recently. Should we assume that they have discussed this and agreed on everything?
I think it's clear from what he has said and what she has said that they do not agree on everything, that there's a great deal of give and take in their relationship. She's talked about it, the role that she plays, as has he, in the White House. And he says that he does ask for her opinion on many subjects. The staff says the same. But she's also said, when the President of the United States crosses the threshold for dinner each night, he does not necessarily need me haranguing him. She said she chooses her moments.
What role has Valerie Jarrett played in the Obama's rise to national prominence?
Valerie Jarrett is an intriguing character.
She's a White House senior advisor.
She is a White House senior advisor, first friend to both of them, protector of both of them. Very much helping Michelle Obama kind of pursue her own ambitions and also her own independent path, protecting her family in the White House. It's kind of intriguing to think that they met way back in the early 1990s when Michelle was looking to leave that fancy law firm and go to work at City Hall. And there was a 34-year-old lawyer named Valerie Jarrett with whom she interviewed, not for a legal job, but in fact for a job in community development. And there was a dinner that Valerie Jarrett, 34, Barack just turning 30, and Michelle, 27, had in Chicago to kind of talk about their future.
Every high-profile political figure endures a certain amount of public scrutiny, and we can say the Obamas have had a uniquely large amount of abuse put upon them. Maybe some say it's because of their race. How have they navigated that?
They broadly navigated it, I think you could say, with grace and with a stiff upper lip. But one of the things I discovered in writing about this book was just how deep and vicious that vitriol was. Of course, it's a polarized country. Some of it was about Michelle Obama's politics. That kind of comes with the turf. But some of it was abjectly racist. And you can see it in stories that I tell in the book, where names are attached to the men, inevitably Republican men who are making fun of her body, who are photoshopping images in quite grotesque ways.
Putting their faces on monkeys, but also making fun of Michelle, saying, well, she talks about nutrition, but she has a weight problem herself.
That's right. A member of Congress was caught saying that not once, but twice.
How has that affected the way they raise their kids?
They are, as parents, they set out to inject some element of normality in a completely bizarre world that they inhabit inside the bubble that is the White House. Small things. Barack comes home for dinner every night. In fact, they talk about it as living above the store. They're actually under one roof far more often than they were when he was campaigning and living and, you know, commuting to Springfield. Michelle supervises sports activities of theirs, play dates, and they also, it's important to remember, they brought in Michelle's mother, who lives in the White House, who's a really important anchor to the girls.
She's the first live-in grandmother since Mamie Eisenhower's mother lived in the White House.
That's right.
But I'm assuming they also consulted with previous presidents about bringing up kids, because the Bushes, the Clintons, both went through that.
Michelle has spoken about just how helpful Laura Bush and Hillary Clinton were to her in plotting charting that life for the two girls. It's also interesting that Michelle said that she spoke with every living first lady, and they had one unanimous piece of advice for surviving in the White House, and that was escape to Camp David, the presidential retreat, as often as possible. Turns out that Michelle likes Camp David a bit more than Barack does.
Now, a lot of first ladies have championed particular causes during their husbands' presidencies. Why did Michelle choose to campaign against childhood obesity, of all things? Her kids aren't overweight.
They are not overweight, and they're both quite athletic. Michelle said she was standing in her kitchen in their house in Hyde Park near the University of Chicago in 2007, and she was allowing herself to imagine this extraordinarily unlikely possibility that Barack would be elected president, and she wondered what she would do. And she thought about gardening and the White House vegetable garden. There had not been a vegetable garden in the White House forever. And
there had been one on the roof, because Walter Scheib had put one in during the Clinton years.
And when they talk about it, I guess they go back to Eleanor Roosevelt's days when they think of an actual sort of victory garden with
in the back
on the South Lawn. And she also said that they took the girls, Malia, the older one, to a pediatrician at one point, and as Barack put it somewhat inelegantly, she was a little chubby at that time. And she looked for issues that resonated with her, because she recognized that she's at her best when she's doing things that she cares about, but also that would help further his agenda, and health care is certainly one of those.
Now, the First Lady gets to take care of all sorts of things that don't want to bother the president with. Her administration of the East Wing has differed from some of her predecessors, and she has been criticized for the unusually high amount of turnover among staff.
There's certainly been turnover among her staff. She replaced her first chief of staff really quite quickly. By the same token, she commands, as far as I can tell, a tremendous amount of loyalty from the people who are closest to her. And I know that from her friends, her relatives, her mentors, people she keeps in touch with. They are really not unlike, frankly, Hillary Clinton. They are intensely loyal to Michelle Obama.
And Hillary Clinton, many people talked about what she had given up in her own career to be the first lady with Bill Clinton. Then that changed after she ran for political office herself. What do you think Michelle Obama's given up, and what do you think is going to happen after this presidency is over in a couple of years?
She's given up a very impressive trajectory in Chicago, where she had risen to be vice president of the University of Chicago Hospital System, a job that not only paid very well, about $300,000 a year, but allowed her to try to connect this elite institution with the impoverished surrounding neighborhoods, which also happened to be full of African Americans who needed a lift. And so she had a purposeful existence, and she had a prominent existence, and it was all her own. Looking ahead, I would imagine she would seek greater independence. She's talked about working on education, which she says is the greatest civil rights challenge that this generation faces.
You don't think she's going to run for office?
I will defer to Barack Obama on that. He was asked recently, if we told you 10 years from now that your wife was running for office, what would you say? He said, I would say that she had been abducted by aliens.
Now, because she hates the political process so much?
Can you imagine her in a room with John Boehner and Mitch McConnell?
You just mentioned that she has a lot of loyalty among her staff. How does she foster that loyalty?
She pays attention. She listens. She is an inveterate hugger. She conveys a sense of she's a mentor through and through. She believes in mentoring to her bones, and that's one thing we can be very confident she will keep doing.
Do you think people pay more attention to the way she dresses than other first ladies?
I think she commands that, doesn't she? She loves clothes. She delights in fashion. And she's been certainly more important to the American fashion industry than anyone since Jackie Kennedy, and also in a very different way from Jackie Kennedy, because she's got that common touch that's so important to her.
Peter Slevin was at the Washington Post for a decade on the national staff before he joined Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, where he's an associate professor. And he's also the biographer of Michelle Obama, Michelle Obama, A Life, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show.
A real pleasure, Leonard. Thanks so much.